All hail the power of Jesus' name, let angels prostrate fall. Bring forth the royal diadem and crown and Lord. Bring forth the royal diadem and crown and Lord of all. Let every tongue and every tribe respond to his call. To him all majesty ascribe and crown him Lord of all.
Everybody, this is the Tag Your It podcast live here coming from 2019. So season three, year three, we haven't quite made the, the full year mark anyway, but we are calling this season three right here.
Seasons of podcasting.
Yeah.
I don't know if I can say excellence, but it's podcasting fun, at least on my part.
Yes, 3 years old. Well, anyway, we're glad that you guys are getting ready to, to make a joke, suffer with us for another year. But it's actually God's providence that has brought Dave and I together. We recognize that we love it, and hopefully he's brought us into your lives to help edify you. Hopefully we help in conversations with your everyday things. And if there's anything more, again, this is another year that interact with us, and hopefully we'll bring some more information, get some more great guests, and put forward the gospel as much as we can.
Speaking of guests, we have an amazing guest tonight, Dr. Sam Waldron. I also want to remind you that we are now part of Kylopolis Institute.
Yes.
So, with that said, that means that we operate under their 501c3 and we're part of their ministry. So if you get a chance, be sure to check out their newest blogs. You can go to kylopolis.org, yes. kylopolis.org, and you can check out the newest blog post. We have Joe Tolan and his great blog post, Bible Reading Plan, and of course, From the Cradle to the Cross by Dr. Jason Crowder. With that said, we got a few little brief announcements that we want to get out there because they're really important. Number one, and this is a cool one, Adam right here will be speaking on March 27th at Southwest Baptist University during their chapel time. So if you are around Bolivar, if you are around Springfield, if you're around Buffalo, make your way over there to see him speak. And you can also pick up one of our books, which will be available there on the table as well. We'll make a great deal for you, I promise. And then likewise, Tim Carter, one of the other Institute Fellows, will be speaking at chapel at SBU on April 29th. Two way cool things.
Yeah, so, and then the other announcement would just be, you know, we've, like I said on the FYI last week, we're getting a little bit more organized, so we've got the events set up to where we have guests coming on. We've already have shows planned, and so thus to announce the next show will be on the 21st, always a Monday, always at 6 o'clock.
Bingo.
We're going to have John Hawkins, which his story is going to be awesome because he was a former LDS, or we're going to still use the word Mormon. That's an issue. Hopefully we can get another somebody to talk about that issue on the show sometime, but he might even talk about it. But anyway, we're going to talk with him about his conversion from the Christ of Mormonism to the Christ that really came, incarnated himself, and revealed the true Father, the true gospel. Anyway, I can't wait until we get to that point. So that'll be the next show. So it's not next week, but it's the following week
21st,
after that.
Yes.
So, and then we got on the 28th, we also have Jason Crowder again, which again, we ended the year off talking with him about this whole Kylopolis thing. He's going to be back on to talk about the rightful place and, or so the biblical foundations of and the rightful place of academia according to scripture, right? So that's the next things up on the dock.
And then finally, I want to let you know, we just had an agreement for a debate that we will have probably towards the end of March also. It's going to be between Tristan Crottinger, who is a member of the Missouri Baptist Apologetics Network, and John Hawkins, who is, of course, going to come on and speak about Mormonism, but he's going to come back on and debate, and we're going to talk about open or closed communion, which is a great discussion that was, of course, sparked by a discussion on the Baptist Review. Yeah. So with that said, we probably better jump on
Well, let's, before, just one thing, again, just as a disclaimer, there's still lots of bugs with the new video production stuff, so again, if our mouths are moving and the audio is a little funky somewhere over here, please let us know, because that'll let me know what I need to do to kind of line things up to make it a better experience for you guys watching, because I know in the past I've watched videos where things were off audio and video wise, and it's very uncomfortable to watch. So anyway, if you guys could help me out by just watching our lips, listening to the sound, making sure they line up, if you say something in the comments, that would be much appreciated. So with that being said, we had announced this a long time ago, but yeah. It's a show that fell through last year because of something coming up, but now we have Dr. Sam Waldron on the show tonight as announced, and he is on the line with us already. Dr. Waldron, how are you doing?
I am really well, brother. We are doing well here in Owensboro, Kentucky, happy, and you're talking about your apologetics ministry there. We had with us just this last week Dr. James White of Alpha and Omega Ministries speaking on the whole subject of the reliability of the New Testament text, and of course he's a well-known apologist as well, and had a great time, best attended modular course we've ever had with about 40 guys there, and God is blessing both the seminary, Covenant Baptist Theological Seminary, and our church. I'm one of three pastors at Grace Reformed Baptist Church in Owensboro, Kentucky.
Amen. Nice. And we are really glad, Dr. Waldron, that you would take the time to visit with us. We talked to you, back in November or October, and we wanted to discuss the 1689 London Baptist Confessions because there's probably not anybody better to talk about it with. You are, of course, the author of the Modern Exposition yes. of the 1689 London Baptist Confessions. Besides that, and besides being president of Covenant Baptist Theological Seminary, you also have some other works out there. If you don't mind, could you tell us the other books that you have so we can also put a plug out for them real quick?
Oh, well, thank you. I'm the author, along with Dr. Richard Barcellus, of Reformed Baptist Manifesto, which is an exposition of this Jeremiah 31, with the subtitle "The New Covenant Constitution of the Church." I'm one of the contributors to a Four Views book that I think is still being used as a text in a lot of seminaries. Who Runs the Church, published by Zondervan, in which, along with Paige Patterson and a Presbyterian and Anglican brother, I defended the view of plural elder congregationalism. Have several books out on eschatology, The End Times Made Simple, More of the End Times Made Simple, and one of my more controversial books, MacArthur's Millennial Manifesto, A Friendly Response. Just recently, Chapel Library has come out with a couple of books, Lectures on the Lord's Day, and then The Regulator Principle of the Church was just published by Chapel Library as well. That's at least a few of them. Baptist Roots in America is one that a short booklet I wrote a long time ago, and another one that's getting translated into a number of other languages right now is To Be Continued, which is my defense of the cessationism.
Nice.
So that's a few of the books.
That's quite a library.
Are
yeah.
out there and bear my name in some way or the other.
Well, let's go ahead and jump on into this interview, if that's okay, because we have, of course, I don't know if you're watching on Facebook, but we do have, of course, your book right up in front here, The Modern Exposition. My real issue, I grew up in a traditionalist Baptist church. I say that in using kind of the terminology or the nuance that we kind of hear thrown around a little bit today. We didn't have a confession. I didn't know what a confession was. So maybe you can help me help others. What is a confession to begin with?
Sure. Well, as the name implies, a confession is what we confess. And the term confess in the original language of the Bible, the Greek language, means to say the same thing as. So a confession of faith is a written and defined proclamation or assertion or affirmation of what we believe the Bible teaches. Hence, the other name for confessions of faith, creeds, from the Latin credo, which is based on the idea of what we believe. So confessions are simply a written and public document in which we say what we think the Bible teaches.
Yeah, so whenever we're thinking about that, so we have people that want to confess what they believe, why they believe it, maybe, whatever. What would you say is the why to confession? So now that we know what confessions are, that they are that my credo, what we believe, why was there a need or why is there a need to write out these confessions?
Sure. Well, the 1689 Baptist Confession originated in a need both to testify to a watching world what the genuine teachings of the early particular or Reformed Baptist were. And so their confession was intended to both assert what they did believe and make clear to everybody that some of the rumors about them were true by making clear that they did not believe other things that the rumor mill said that they did believe. For instance, it was commonly thought that the Baptists were Anabaptists and that carried with it a really bad idea in terms of the relationship of the Christian to the civil state, and it also carried with it the notion that Baptists were advocates of free will or semi-Pelagianism, and so those were a couple of the reasons why the original confession was written. So in one sense, it was a matter of their testimony. Mm-hmm. They wrote this confession as a matter of testimony, but they also wrote the confession as a matter of unity. They wanted to put down on paper the things that the 100 or so churches that had representatives in London in 1689, those hundred churches agreed about, and so they could not only testify to the world, but they could state the things upon which they would build their association of Baptist churches, the doctrinal convictions about which they agreed. So the confession was written both as a way of unifying the particular Baptist movement and also testifying to the world with regard to those things that they wanted the world to know they did not believe, and also expressing their unity with the broader Christian community. The 1689 Confession borrows 80%+ of its language from the Westminster Confession, through the mediating document of the Savoy Declaration of Faith, which is its immediate primary predecessor, and doing that, the Reformed Baptists were saying, look, we're part of the Reformed and Puritan movement in England. We want to use the language of the Westminster Confession and of the Savoy Declaration to show that we're on basic theological issues of one mind with our Christian brethren in the Reformed and Puritan movement in England.
So let me do a little bit of a sidetrack from what we have here on our, you know, some of our written questions. And I'm doing that because I know that we live in a time where individuals lose track of where things happened in history and what things are going on in history. What was the result of the 1689 Baptist Confession? What was a little bit of the preamble that built up to it? If that's okay that I ask you to kind of contextualize before we jump exactly into some of its significance today. Is that okay?
Yeah, I think so. I'll do my best with that. what led up to the 1689 Baptist Confession? Well, just about the time the Westminster Confession was being penned and put together by the Westminster Assembly in the mid-1640s in England, at that same time, something called the First London Baptist Confession of Faith, the 1689 is actually the Second London Baptist Confession of Faith. The First London was being published by the original seven particular Baptist churches in the London area. Well, after the publication of the Westminster Confession, there was a lot of persecution going on of the whole Puritan movement in England, including the particular Reformed Baptist, and there was the great expulsion in 1662 of the Puritan ministers, most of them from the Church of England, and then increasing persecution up till the time of the Glorious Revolution in 1688, when a great deal more and substantial religious freedom was attained in England. At that point, it was now legal for Baptists to meet together. It was legal for their churches to publish things, and it was in connection with the Glorious Revolution of 1688 that these representatives of 100 churches gathered in London and put their names to the 1689 Baptist Confession. It was actually a document that already existed and had been penned by a couple of Reformed Baptist pastors who pastored together in London, and their names were Nehemiah Cox and William Collins. And they had actually written and published this confession in 1677. It was adopted by all 100 churches in 1689.
I really appreciate that. Amazing. I'll bet that's not the first time that you've been asked to give a little bit of the historical context of it. That was really, in my mind, exceptionally important, again, because we live in a time where people lose track of history. Yeah. They quickly lose track of history.
And I mean, we got to really, whenever it comes to Baptist history, we do have to realize that there was a lot of oppression a lot of people, like John Bunyan. He was thrown in jail. I mean, he was a yeah. Baptist kind of guy. He was thrown in jail. That's where he wrote the Pilgrim's Progress and a lot of his things. So there was a lot of persecution so you had Protestantism breaking away from this pretty much state-controlled Catholic Church, and then it re-happened again with the Anglican Church in England taking over as the state church, and then you had these guys going, no, we're not going to submit ourselves. And so that's why in the 1689 London Baptist Confession, you have that freedom of conscience issue that you don't have an implicit faith. And so that's why, you know, these things are so important, because they do allow, if you don't believe, well, this just isn't your confession. And so you have Presbyterians and Congregationalists and Baptists all going, here's our unity, and then here's our distinctiveness. Mm-hmm. But they're brothers, so there's still a unity amongst, even if you don't meet at the same place on Sunday.
So before I jump into our question about the relationship between the Baptist faith and message and the 1689, I want to kind of gradually lean that way. So the 1689 is written, and we then see a movement of Baptists over to the United States. Kind of tell me how the 1689 begins to influence the Baptist faith in the United States, of course, leading up to the Civil War, and then bringing us to basically the, because we're both Southern Baptists, both Adam and I, the creation of the Southern Baptist Convention. I know that's a big gap there, but if you could maybe help me get to the Southern Baptist from the 1689.
Sure. Well, obviously you have the whole emigration from England of Puritan and Reformed believers who looked to the New World as a place where they'd have more liberty and opportunity. And among those Puritan believers were Baptists, and they brought the 1689 Baptist Confession to the colonies at that point. Wasn't the United States yet. In about 1740, what was substantially the 1689 Confession was adopted by the Philadelphia Association of Churches As the Philadelphia Confession of Faith. I think the date is actually 1742, if memory serves. At any rate, that with a couple of very minor additions, that was the 1689 Baptist Confession. You'll find the 1689 Baptist Confession in its original form without the two slight additions in the American Philadelphian Confession, but you'll find the 1689 Confession published as and called the Philadelphia Confession, even though it's being published in the original 1689 version and not with a couple of small additions that were made in the Philadelphia Confession. At any rate, about 1740, what's going on is the Great Awakening. Now, till about 1740, there were probably equal numbers of Arminian Baptist churches and particular Baptist churches or Calvinistic Baptist churches in the United States. But with the Great Awakening and in the ministry of George Whitfield and Jonathan Edwards and the great Reformed and Puritan progenitors of the Great Awakening and ministers in the Great Awakening, in the colonies and then in the United States, particular Baptist or Reformed Baptist churches began to greatly predominate. And the Confession of Faith, which was often held was always greatly influential among those churches, was the 1689 Baptist Confession of Faith. There were a couple different streams of Calvinistic Baptist. If you study the history, you'll read about the regular Baptist. The regular Baptists were more the direct descendants of the English particular Baptists. The separate Baptists were more the products of the Great Awakening and revivals that followed it. And the regulars tended to be more insistent on good church order and careful doctrinal statements. The positive thing about the separates was that they were very, very evangelistic and zealous. And but in a lot of places, those two streams kind of coalesced. I think the separates were pretty strong in the South, particularly where the evangelistic impetus and revivalistic impetus was really strong. Anyway, so by the end of the 1700s, 90 to 95% of the Baptist churches in the United States were Calvinistic Baptist churches, and the most influential Confession of Faith, in fact. At that point, I'm not sure there was another Confession of Faith that was influencing them, was the 1689 Baptist Confession. Now, that's kind of the high water point for the movement towards Reformed Baptist or particular Baptist theology. And that continues. Especially in the South, but also in the North, up to the Civil War, most of the Baptist churches would have been Calvinistic. But after the American Revolution, there does tend to be a reaction beginning to set in, and it has political overtones. But there's a reaction setting in against Calvinism. In the United States, some Wag has said that Americans didn't like a sovereign king, and they didn't like a sovereign God either. And there is some measure of truth to that. Anyway, Calvinism continues to be a strong force throughout Baptist life in the United States up to about the Civil War. Southern Seminary, the first of the Southern Baptist seminaries, was founded by Boyce in the 1850s, and though he did not adopt the 1689 in terms of its thoroughgoing adoption of it, he abstracted a number of principles. So the confession is called the Abstract of Principles. The Abstract of Principles was abstracted from the 1689 Baptist Confession of Faith, and the briefest the briefest acquaintance with the abstract of principles will show you that the 1689 is its source. It's simply an abbreviation of the major peculiar doctrinal principles of the 1689. Anyway, and of course, so that's the foundation of Southern Seminary. And of course, fast forward 150 years later, that abstract of principles is the foundation upon which L. Mohler managed to reform the seminary and call it back from liberalism to its conservative roots.
Amen.
Anyway, so a lot of influences then come in, especially in the North, but gradually in the South as well. The modernist controversy, the fundamentalist controversy, the influence of Methodism, the revival, of the revivalist movement, and that leads to a downgrade in all sorts of ways from the high doctrinal crest of the 1689 Baptist Confession. And you also have the New Hampshire Confession, which is not a revision so much as an addition, abbreviation, and orientation of the 1689 Confession to answer some of the Arminian objections that are beginning to be cried aloud against Calvinism in the 1800s. And so the New Hampshire Confession is written. I know Tom Nettles believes it is a Calvinistic document. It's certainly briefer than the 1689, and it's oriented to answering and making clear that the charges of hyper-Calvinism and fatalism and not believing in human responsibility are not true. And that was kind of the origin of the New Hampshire Confession in the 1800s as well.
Wow.
Yeah, and I know as it gets on down there, I mean, I've did some study of the Baptist faith and message, and when you get to 1925, that's whenever they were kind of realizing that there was still that anti-creedal spirit that propped up somehow, but they did use the New Hampshire as kind of not necessarily a basis, but a guide into making the Baptist faith, the message, which that would be the first one. I mean, the Founders has a great book from Tom Askell that can kind of take you from there on the whole traditionalist controversy. It's $11 on Founders Ministries.
Just bought mine today.
Yes. But anyway, I mean, basically what we're getting at here is there's a ton of history that needs to be put in. So we're not just looking at a document and just accepting a document as is, but there's a history to it. It is meaningful. It's not just meaningful in American history or English history, but in the whole scope of redemptive history and how the church responds to the world around it. That's why these documents are very meaningful, because it's not necessarily authoritative or anything as far as scripture goes, but it does go to show you how Christ is building his church throughout history. It's a necessary thing. Again, we've touted on our show before, church history is important, as important to learn as anything else in the Christian life. So I hope Sam Waldron has, I hope people have heard you explain all this stuff, and I hope it gets people excited. I mean, I might look like a nerd, but I love this stuff, and I thank you for taking your time to take us through that historical thing, because that can't be excluded from the document, because it's not a vacuum.
And you did. You just brought us right round full surface to, of course, the foundation for the 1925 Baptist Faith and Message, which then, of course, is revised in 63 and then in 2000. Let's get more directly and specific into your book, if that's okay. I know we built a lot of framework to that, and so we want to be as respectful as we can with your time. So in your book, The Modern Exposition of the 1689 Baptist Confession, in Appendix D, you deal with the proper handling of the confession. Is it still relevant today, and why?
Well, the 1689 represents the high water mark, along with the Savoy Declaration and Westminster Confession of Faith, of the creedal formulation that grew out of the Reformation. And while as what we confess and what we believe, a creed and a confession, we certainly don't attribute divine or infallible authority to the confession. The 1689 still represents the high water mark for Baptists of creedal formulation. Everything since then is abbreviations of it, abstracts of it, and the 1689 still represents, in the great creedal tradition of the Church, that creedal tradition oriented towards Baptist life and Baptist doctrine. So sometimes when I teach the confession, I say there are three things that really go into the confession. There's historic orthodoxy, because you have the historic doctrine of the Trinity and the historic doctrine of the person of Christ. There's Reformed theology, so you have the doctrines of grace taught in the confession. Of course, all of that stuff is in the Westminster Confession and flows right into the 1689. But the peculiar thing for Baptist is that in the 1689, you have Baptist principles. And so you have a chapter 26, which talks about not just the universal church, but the local church, and how that church is to be organized on Baptist principles. And of course, you also have the treatment of the ordinances or the sacraments of the church and baptism and the Lord's table from a Baptist perspective as well. And there are other changes that represent the Baptist principles. Anyway, so that's where the 1689, that's what the 1689 is. And I think it's indisputable that the 1689 is the high watermark of Baptist creedal formulation. It's possible that in the future there'll be a higher watermark, but it hasn't happened yet. Okay.
Yeah, and that's one thing that Dave and I were discussing. It's like, so Sam, when are we going to see you try to get? We had this done in England a long time ago. When are you going to lead a bunch of Reformed Baptists to convene, and so that we can take this document? And because I know you talked about this in the book, is, you know, maybe someday in the future we'll be able to get together and kind of like those little things that need clarification, you know, like the whole Pope issue or little things that, you know, people have. Like, when are you going to take the helm and go like, we need to take this document and make it the whatever year American Baptist confession, you know?
Well, this is one of those questions that I feel very comfortable answering with these three words. I don't know.
Yeah. It's a lot to ask. It's a lot to ask, but yeah.
You know, I'm certainly open to the possibility, but, you know, we don't want to lose what we've gained in such a revision of the confession. Yeah. What we have is a document that is really a great center point and a center of gravitation for Baptists, and has proved a really unifying document in many ways. Mm-hmm. And we don't want to, in a premature way, put out revisions of it, expansions of it that won't find wide acceptance and won't detract from the measure of good the 1689 does. The point is, I'm saying, I'm certainly open to the idea. It's not an infallible divine document, so I'm open to the idea that church history goes on, and the creedal formulation of the church, therefore, must go on. But whether it's timely to do that now, that's a much different question.
Yeah. So, you know, you're talking about, just the use of it and that it kind of stands alone right now, like you said, as something good, good enough, sufficient enough for a confession. So what is that proper handling of the confession? I know that the appendix is like, you know, it's an easy chapter to read, so I know that the summary of it can be shorter. But what would you say that the proper handling of especially the 1689, what is that?
Well, yeah, that's a boy, there are many facets to that question, and Tom Nettles has written some good stuff on Founders about this as well. And let me just encourage your readers to read his stuff. But I think it's important. Well, let me just give All right, if I give the little historical background of that appendix, I suppose. Number of years ago, I was actually a student at Southern Seminary doing my PhD there, and one of the other professors there, a man by the name of Sean Wright, wrote a piece in 9 marks, basically saying that the 1689, whatever its value was, wasn't a good confession for local churches. And he alleged a number of reasons why it wasn't. And one of the things that happened there, though, that was that he misunderstood how a Reformed Baptist actually used the confession. He assumed in his treatment of the 1689 and the Reformed Baptist that we believed that all the members of the 1689 church had to be full subscriptionists. That is to say, had to subscribe the confession in the same sense in which the elders or pastors of the church would subscribe it. And I felt like that misunderstanding needed to be exposed. And so I wrote what appears in my appendix in the book to expose that error. You know, he had said something like, you know, if you're going to use this confession, then all the members of the church have to believe in the Christian Sabbath, all the members of the church have to believe in particular redemption, and all the members of the church have to believe in six-day creationism. Well, he's certainly right. The confession teaches all of those things. Yeah. And I certainly would be unashamedly committed to teaching all those things in my own church, but I'm not committed to the notion that everybody who joins the church has to be a convinced Christian Sabbatarian or convinced of limited atonement. And I've pastored 3 different Reformed Baptist churches now over the last 40 years, and none of them took that position or held the idea that each member had to be a full subscriptionist. So, you know, it was simply a misunderstanding of the Reformed Baptist faith and practice at that point. And what I argued was that the way the confession is to be used is that, yes, I mean, the officers of the church, especially the pastors, need to subscribe it. And the reason they need to do that, if it's a 1689 church, is that they have to teach it. Mm-hmm. But the members of the church do not have to be full subscriptionist, although that's the goal of the life and teaching of the church, is to bring the members of the church gradually along and organically along into affirming more and more confidently and clearly the teaching of the whole confession, so that the confession becomes a teaching document then that's used for the maturation of the members of the church. But the members of the church don't have to start out there. The members of the church simply have to submit to the confession. They don't have to subscribe it. Yes. And I talked about how the fact is that in human authority, the primary duty of those who are put under the various human authorities is not blind faith or complete agreement, but submission. And I use the illustration of a woman. She doesn't have to make the commitment when she gets married that she believes absolutely everything and that her husband does and agrees with him about absolutely everything. But she simply has to submit to him. And of course, a measure of agreement's necessary. If you're going to have a sweet and peaceful and loving relationship, but there doesn't have to be a perfect agreement. And no more do church members in coming into or joining a 1689 church have to perfectly agree or fully understand the confession of faith.
Man, I love that as a teaching tool element is exceptionally important. I want to kind of move a little bit off script, and I know we want to be really, really good with your time. And so with that said, I kind of want to be a little bit more applicable to my current church. I hope that's okay that I put you in that position. But our church is kind of
fine.
our church is kind of reevaluating some things. We are looking to, well, we're actually reevaluating our constitution. We're going to try to do a both and with the Baptist Faith and Message 2000 and the 1689 London Baptist Confession. Is that something that a church can do? And why is that a bad thing or a good thing?
Well, I don't think it's a bad thing in the abstract for a church to hold more than one doctrinal statement, because one of the purposes of affirming doctrinal statements is to affirm your unity with Christians of other generations, and to show where you stand in the great stream of the Christian tradition. Okay.
Yeah, amen.
For instance, I was a pastor in Grand Rapids, Michigan for 24 years with the Reformed Baptist Church of Grand Rapids. And we held, because we sat there in the middle of the large, large Dutch Reformed community in Grand Rapids, we actually adopted the Canons of Dort as one of our church statements of faith. Made one exception to the place for the Canons of Dort assert infant baptism, but we put the Canons of Dort in our church constitution as one of our doctrinal platforms, and it was because we felt it was a good way of stating the fact that we held with the larger Dutch Reformed community the great principles and the first great statement of this systematic statement of the doctrines of grace. Now, so I don't have in principle, a problem with the church also holding something like the Baptist Faith and Message. I'm not really, really familiar with the Baptist Faith and Message because I'm a Yankee and my background is not Southern Baptist, okay? But the only thing I would say is, if I was going to hold multiple confessions, I would want to make it quite clear that in any case of question or discussion, that the assertions and definitions of the 1689 would trump the other confession of faith.
Yes, and that's something that I've had to, you know, express is, you know, I can hold to the, oh, somebody is talking to us from the computer. Anyway, that's the awesome thing about a live show. Anyway, but I've had to explain that, you know, I can accept the Baptist Faith and Message 2000, especially knowing what happened from 1925 to 1963 as far as taking out that corruption issue, probably as an umbrella to, you know, include a lot more people in the Southern Baptist tradition. But I have presuppositions, and my presuppositions can be found in the 1689, it's totally okay. So that's, you know, how we can explain it. So if, you know, there's somebody out there that I love the 1689, but I'm Southern Baptist, you know, I think that's probably the quickest and best way to be able to explain the situation is my presuppositions are found in the 1689, but I fully agree with the BF&M 2000 or whatever. But that's awesome.
Yeah.
Go for it.
Yeah, I think you have to say something like that because the Baptist Faith and Message 2000 is obviously at a number of points. Now, at a number of points, it adds great statements about the family and the civil order and stuff like that. That's great.
Yeah.
But in other places, in terms of some of the great doctrines of the faith, it's a lot more vague or unclear than the 1689. I was just looking it over to reacquaint myself with the Baptist Faith and Message of 2000, and, you know, certainly don't want to, that my purpose is not to bring a critique here. It's only to say that I think that the language of the 1689 needs to be seen as its background and used to clarify its statements. There's a really odd use of the term attributes in the paragraph on the Trinity, where it talks about each person of the Trinity having certain personal attributes. I think the term attributes is normally used in the theological tradition to refer to what all the persons have in common as being God. And the proper word there would be properties, personal properties and relationships. And so that's just a little indication that the language of the 1689 would be the more traditional and commonly used theological language with regard to an issue like that.
Well, Dr. Waldron, I just want to thank you so much for your time, and I'm looking forward to getting down to Kentucky and getting to meet you face-to-face sometime in the next few years as I begin my program at Covenant Baptist Theological Seminary in the fall of this year, Lord willing. I have to say, I was super excited when I got that letter, and I already kind of told you that, but sharing that with everyone else.
And I can't wait to get secondhand, non-certified graduation from your seminary, too, by listening to Dave. And, you know, I read the Modern Exposition in a week and 2 days, just to let you know. I love it, and that's how I did it, is just because... you know, just to let the people out there know, again, it is it's easy to read. I kind of equate it to like Wayne Grudem's Bible Doctrine. So it's laid out very well. The text isn't like overbearingly small. And so it's one of those things that you can get through it. But yes, you have to really love church history. You have to love getting to know those deeper things about things. And so that's, again, what Sam does with the historical issues behind, you know, it's a modern exposition, so he's getting into the grammatical historical method, what we use with the Bible, kind of, and that's what we do with all great works of antiquity, to know what the intention of the document says. So, you know, again, I devoured it, so now I need to go back slower and and do little questions in the back and stuff like that, and get the I guess the unapproved degree from CTS.
So we just
we hope to meet you sometime, and David, we look forward to having you come over for one of our modular courses and get to a fellowship with you personally.
Man, thank you so much, brother. Well, we will let you go. Yeah. Have a great evening, and look forward to being able to interact with you in the future.
All right, thank you very much.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
That was great. And it was good. Of course, we knew it would take longer than what we planned. Yeah. And that was really good because there was amazing stuff there. Yeah. And here's what I'm going to say. If you just joined in, I want to encourage you to jump right back at the end of the podcast. Listen to that. I'm going to listen to it again. The historical element is, I mean, amazing.
Because like he gave us some information that's not in here because he only took us up to a certain point. So he kind of gave us that history in between. And so that's going to be something of a resource that, you know, maybe we need to transcribe or something real quick, because that's some history that will get
us.
Because as Baptist, Southern Baptist, if you have hung around a little bit and if you're in the know, there's stuff going on. We've talked about it, but, you know, there is a constant bickering between some people that shouldn't be bickering. It should be actually talking. And, you know, we've addressed somebody in particular that's a little bit on the extreme pendulum.
I want to know who is writing the histories on the other side.
Yeah.
Because they're not. And they're not researched. And history is going to tell you the truth about where we have been. Mm-hmm. And if you watch the liberal slide that occurred in our denomination, it was an anti-reformed liberal slide. Okay, so with that said, let's switch gears real quick. We need to switch gears hard here.
Oh, yes.
And we've only got a few minutes because we are trying to be really good at 1 hour on the show. I promised my wife, I said, give me 5 minutes plus, because we had a little bit of a wager on this. So that moves us to an
wager,
amazing...
Wager. Yeah, well, you mean more like roulette. That's what we talk about.
Yeah.
But anyway...
Here we go to the video that you have probably seen on... you have most likely seen this video occur... in some type of social media thread, you've seen it pass. We're not able tonight to pull the video up. We had this great idea. It was kind of giving us a little bit of a drag, and we didn't want to do that.
Yeah.
So with that said, we're on the video. You can see it. It's called Kids Meet Someone Who Had an Abortion. And, of course, we want to give a shout-out to our dear friend of the show, Kevin Meyer. We promised him that we would get to this. We love Kevin. He is amazing. And we are so thankful for his continued work in abolishing abortion. We're going to have him back on. Man, we love Kevin. I mean, every day he is out there at the gates of death picketing. Yeah. He's an amazing, amazing saint in the way that he makes sure that lives are saved and people hear the gospel. And so we want to shout out to Kevin. Kevin, this video is for you. Our breakdown of it is for you, brother. We love
A-M-B-A,
you.
A-M-B-A, Kevin Myers. Awesome. But anyway, Dave sent this one over to me, and man, whenever I read it, it's abominable, really, just to, you know, see just the absolute nonchalantness of the conversation. I mean, yeah, we don't want to get overheated so we can actually have a debate, but this is one-sided indoctrination, and it hits right at the heart because it's kids that probably don't have people in their life to really influence them with the gospel, and so they're just hearing this kind of stuff. But anyway, yeah, it's a grown adult person, a lady that's had an abortion, talking with kids and getting their opinions and giving her opinions, and they're just gumming about it. So anyway, we're going to go to the video real quick and we'll do our commenting.
Do you think that sometimes it's not okay?
I got to actually
get the sound going in.
Get the sound going in. Here we go.
Okay, to have an abortion?
I want to say if you're being reckless, if there's nothing wrong going on,
I don't know. I just don't agree.
Right there. Stop it right there. So look at the kid having more moral fortitude than the adult. Again, you have a child, a probably 10-year-old kid, sitting with a 30-year-old adult, telling the adult, of course, is again indoctrinating this kid. And when the kid says, I don't think it's right, the adult, of course, bullies the kid into saying, hey, it's great to kill kids.
Well, right now here is she says, well, I disagree. And then the kid, gives this, huh? So he's like, you disagree with what I just said?
You disagree.
So, I mean, he's got, because what now, his morals are going to get challenged.
Again.
And he, even though he might, I mean, he looks like a smart kid. He probably is a smart kid. But the thing is he's going to get railroaded with a bunch of arbitrary,
And here's why this is important. If parents aren't prepared to be able to have this dialogue with their kids, this is the garbage that they're going to get in the public school system. Mm-hmm. And again, with not only the public school system, population at large. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Kids meet someone who's had...
So what are we here to talk about today?
An abortion. So that's that was the title screens. Yeah.
Well... I had an abortion.
Oh.
So what do you know?
Again, right there.
What have you heard?
I had an abortion is the way that she begins this conversation. She puts the kids in a position where, okay, now you're going to have to either affirm me, which human beings like to do. They like to affirm others, or you're going to have to clash with me.
Yeah. And it's, again, it's just I don't know what it takes. I mean, this is just total depravity. The suppression of the truth to get from I murdered a life.
That's what you're going to see is a justification.
To get to the point where you can just be like, I had an abortion. And you can sit down and talk with kids on a just little metal chairs, just like, yeah, I had one.
About abortion.
I don't exactly know what happens, but you go and basically get rid of the baby from inside you.
What have you heard?
That.
Same thing. Have you ever talked to somebody about abortion before?
I actually wrote a paper in fifth grade about it.
Wow. What was your paper about?
Abortion is okay.
Uh-huh.
And it also depends on, what's happening and why they
got... Okay, so pause right there. I want to put this into perspective. If a kid were to write a paper on the Holocaust is okay, do you think that that paper would be allowed in any school? No stinking way. It would be a hate crime. But here's what we've done. We've redefined humanity. We've redefined what life is. And therefore, we've allowed individual kids, 10-year-olds, to be brainwashed into the idea that it's great. It's okay to kill a living human being because it's not the human being that I want it to be.
Yeah, and then that there's situations, and it's what those situations are that you need to know. So this just becomes relativistic. It becomes arbitrary. And again, because of redefinition, I mean, now we're dealing with just arbitrary, changing, influx moral principles. And I look like the weirdo that goes, wait a second, this has always been this way, and it's life, and this is murder, and all this kind of stuff. Yet I'm the weirdo trying to, you know, trying to find stability. But then again, when it comes to other things, oh no, it's always been this way, and we can't do it.
But why watch a video like this? Why share a video like this? Why discuss a video like this? Here's the challenge: sit down with your kids and point out the theological problems. Again, they have just given a justification for destroying a human being created in the image of God, and they've said, "Hey, it's good. Thumbs up, baby."
Mm-hmm. Got the abortion. So you think it's okay, depending on the circumstances?
Yes.
So the kid has just offered a very, what I would say, generic justification that you're going to hear all the time. That's the first step that those in the pro-death movement will make. Yes. Well, it's okay some of the times. There's times when it's going to come. No, not at all. The Christian position is, no, it's always evil and it's always murder.
Yeah, because then it goes in from babies, and then it goes to whenever you get old and you become not productive in society. And they can count you as some extra baggage that is leeching off the government's money, or however, whatever arbitrary argument that they want. They could use the same thing against you at the end of your life to do the same. Oh, but whatever situation, it's okay to kill old people. And so then we have it on both sides. It's only because of pragmatism and economics. I don't care if you're a capitalist, socialist, whatever. It comes down to money. And how useful you are, because on the worldview that these guys have to come from, if they're not Christian, and if they're not submitting to the scripture of the revelation of God, then they are going, you are just particles here by random chance over time, and we get to define what you are, and you are only what you are worth. And if you guys remember our past debate
last year,
they made the statement that nobody is created equal. I can't believe that they actually claim that, but guess what? The same guys are probably on the other end when it comes to all the refugees and all this other life, too. So, wishy-washy.
Again, if you take... Go for it. I can say it later.
Okay. Did you have an abortion?
A few years ago, I got pregnant, and I really didn't want to have a baby.
May I ask what happened?
She was pregnant and she really didn't want to have a baby. Okay, this is what you need to do. You need to think with your brain here. Okay, so she hasn't talked about being raped or anything. She just, she got pregnant and she didn't want to have a baby. Why can't you reverse that? I don't want to have a baby, so I will not do what it takes to become pregnant.
Because you don't have...
Scientifically... We have come to the knowledge of how that happens. Sorry that you can't control yourself, but the fact is, you do the thing that causes the thing's gonna happen. So, maybe if you didn't, maybe if you were principled, maybe if you were disciplined, oh, but I accidentally, okay, well, guess what? Just because you accidentally did something doesn't mean you get to murder somebody. I don't, this is like, backwards thinking. If you don't want something, you don't do the thing that, if you don't want to get go to jail, you don't rob the bank. You don't do the thing that causes the thing.
It's a lack of responsibility. Yeah. And again, here is the key focus of this. Mm-hmm. You have to take that worldview based upon a principle of convenience, based upon the very idea that I am the center of my own universe. When those are your high priorities and your main moral imperative, you're able to justify whatever gets in the way of you not being the center and whatever gets in the way of you not being the most convenient. Here's the problem. That type of worldview becomes self-destructive because someone comes along and is able to destroy you. Here is where the real issue is. All the problems that are about to be addressed, all of the convenient issues, can easily be turned, reworded, and imported into an argument for someone knocking off the elderly. Again, euthanasia. This is the issue. And who are they trying to, again, Who are they trying to desensitize to the culture of death? It is children. What will those children do when they see the inconvenience of people in our generation or the generation above us? Well, they'll use the same arguments because they're based upon the same lost worldview.
Well, the other thing is, you know, we have a world full of, since we're all independent thinking autonomous creatures, right? Your employer just doesn't want you around anymore. Doesn't have to give you a reason. Just fires you. What are you going to think about that? Your spouse, I just fell out of love with you. I'm taking my stuff and going. You keep the kids. I don't want them either. And if that's a good enough excuse, oh, no, but you're going to take the person to court because you want money if you got the kids from that person because, this is absurd. I don't want responsibility. I don't want to recognize that I am responsible before a holy God who has designed his creation in a certain way, and that there's meaning for babies, there's meaning for mommies, there's meaning for daddies, and that there's a meaning for it all to come together and be so meaningful and beautiful because it's designed that way. You are rebelling in this attitude against the Father who you know and are suppressing the truth. And look where it has landed. Just nonchalant talking about abortion in front of kids. Like it's nothing.
Condom, did the condom break? Was it pre-ejaculation?
Such good questions, Vanessa.
Thank you.
He wasn't wearing a condom.
Why wasn't he wearing a condom?
Have you ever had two options and one...
Here's where you're going to have to justify yourself, because he wasn't wearing a condom. Okay, so now that we have prophylactics now, because I mean, I hear this all the time. Well, we need greater access to all these kind of things
This woman has enough money
to
have access to anything. She has access to a digital video camera and can produce a video and share it like crazy on social media.
Yeah.
I'm pretty sure the lady has enough money to go into a gas station or have her boyfriend go into a gas station for 75 cents or whatever.
If you want to do it, if we have that available, why can't you buy your own stuff and use it and cause it to not happen? So if he wasn't wearing a condom, then you were definitely playing with fire. And so it was your decision, and because your decision happened that way, you murdered somebody over that.
About four more minutes, sorry.
One of them, like, seems easier at the time.
Oh, yeah. Like, you could take a shortcut, or you could go the long way.
It was the shortcut
around.
Version. Mm.
What did your partner think at the time?
You know, I think we were both, like, bummed out that I got pregnant. And he was just
that is the exact opposite of what you should feel when a child comes into this world. It is joy. Life is joy.
Yeah.
How many people pay thousands of dollars so that they can, I mean, literally millions of dollars are paid every year so that people can have children?
Yeah.
There are all kinds of fertility drugs.
But the thing
that are
is,
taken.
We've got to recognize we're sinners. And I'm going to tell you right now, I'll give my confession. I was bummed too, but did my bummedness lead to killing my daughter? No. And guess what? My boy, we weren't trying. Now, we enjoyed the benefits of marriage.
That's right, amen.
Things happened to where we couldn't use certain things, and I got surprised one day with a card on the table that's saying, here it is, and I had to go, you know? And even though in my heart, I went, another one. What am I going to do? Well, I learned from the first time that what a gift they are from God. That's God's grace in life.
Amen.
But still, again, even if we, through in sin, because we're all sinful and we all want to go to that, well, my life is going to change because of a kid. Why does it lead to murder? You know, it doesn't have to go to murder just because you're bummed. So it's one of those things that we do need to recognize the gift of God and the beautifulness of. So being bummed is in reality because of sin. That's the way we feel. But why does being bummed about being pregnant lead to murder? Is the question.
Like, supportive of what I wanted to do.
Were you reckless at the time?
I mean, I don't.
You don't want to answer the question.
I wouldn't really say that I was being reckless.
Reckless.
Mistakes happen.
Yeah.
And
mistakes happen.
You just don't.
So mistakes happen and you kill people.
Do that in the moment. You know what I mean?
I don't know.
I'm glad.
When you have an abortion, what exactly do you do to, like, have the abortion?
You go to the doctor, and they put this little straw inside of your cervix, and then inside of your uterus, and then they just suck the pregnancy out.
There's a problem.
No.
That,
no.
We gotta end there because we're out of time.
Yes.
But goodness sakes. Just, and she's going to describe this as, it's just like going to the dentist.
So now, whenever you're around the kids, you kind of clean up your attitude. So here's where it goes too far. You can just go, you put a straw up there. I mean, no. These kids have the internet too, and unfortunately they can get to the atrocious scenes of blood and guts and articles where doctors say that they personally cut the vocal cords so they don't hear the baby scream. It's out there. Don't suppress the truth and unrighteousness. It is wrong and it's sin. And this video that's been going around makes light of something absolutely dark.
Take your kids to it if you have the opportunity. Show them that this is wrong. We want to encourage you, if you are friends with Kevin Myers, to encourage him. And he stands every day at the doors of death. We are friends with him. He's a friend of the program. We're going to have him on again this year because we are grateful for him. We want to work harder on that partnership this year. And we're so thankful for not only him, but others who are going to try to stand in the way to do everything they can to save lives. This is somewhere where you can not only share the gospel to your kids, you can also point out the fallacies that are there.
Yes, so. And then also we've had Jeff Durbin on the show over the last summer.
Yes.
There's End Abortion Now that you can also get tracks and other things from. Go there if you go back in our backlog. It's Jeff Durbin and End Abortion Now. Listen to that episode. There's links and resources on there for you to help people like Kevin do the ministry at the gates of death. So anyway, we do have to end the show. Sorry to end the show on such a mean tone anyway. But
no, the gospel is good. God saves you.
Yes.
No matter how terrible
you are. But at the same
time,
this is not just a sin that leaves you. This is not the unforgivable sin. If somebody's teaching you that, they're also lying to you and adding lie upon lie. But the thing is God is a gracious God, and right now is the day of salvation. And do not harden your heart if you hear his voice. Come, repent, and become a part of a community that can take care of you.
Right.
Pregnant, not pregnant, whatever. You can find a church. They will take care of you if they are true Christ-centered missional church. Anyway,
big thanks to Sam Waldron for coming on the show. Thank you always to Kevin Myers for what he does.
Yes.
We want to thank our great partners at
Kylopolis
Institute, both Dr. Crowder and Brother Tim Corder. So
anyway,
with that said,
this is the Tag Garrett Podcast. I'm Ray Ray.
And I am Dave.
And soli
Deo
Gloria.